Blog Talk Radio.
So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview. And Mr. Media is recorded live, for the most part, from the new media capital of the world and home of bands such as Savatage, To the Gallows, Cannibal Corpse, Morbid Angel, Deicide, Obituary, Hate Eternal, Monstrosity, Nocturnus, Atheist, and Asheron. When word reached us last night that singer Ronnie James Dio lost his battle against cancer yesterday at the age of 67, my wife said, "Didn't you interview him?" Yes, I did. It was May 22, 1986, one of the first interviews at my new job as pop music critic for the Tampa Tribune. It was a telephone interview, as so many were in those days. Now, sadly, the audio quality has been greatly diminished by the years. In fact, it may not have been very good to begin with, but I'm a pack rat, so I kept it. Now, I can't even prove that a story based on the interview ever ran in the Tribune, because I can't find it, and there's no electronic record. So the audio quality may have been so bad at the time that I couldn't do anything. The only thing I can confirm here is that there's a part at the end of this interview where he talked about Christmas, and that did appear in a story I wrote for the Orlando Sentinel and several other newspapers. In that, he said, "I remember hardly any Christmases, whether as a child or as an adult. Christmas is not my big one. I think it's a complete and utter waste of time for me. For some people, it's wonderful. It's wonderful for children. Christmas should be for children. It's just a shame that all the adults have to go through all the bother to make it so wonderful for them. I find it to be just a merchandising nuisance. I think that it's just been completely and totally blown out of proportion." Now, I'm going to play my interview with Dio in just a minute, but I must warn you, the sound is really muffled. I'm not underselling this. To increase his voice so you could hear him, I had no choice but to raise mine. It's a stereo mono thing, and I don't have the expertise here. This interview has never been heard before. If you're a fan of Ronnie James Dio, you'll probably be entertained. If not, it may just be a little too hard to sit through, and if that's the case, I certainly understand. If you're new to Mr. Media Radio, I hope you'll drop by our website at www.mrmedia.com, mrmedia.com. That's where you can find my other lost interviews, including Gene Simmons of Kiss and the late John Denver, as well as more than 500 more recent interviews with your favorite TV and film stars, musicians, sports stars, as well as authors, politicians, and other media newsmakers. Again, that's www.mrmedia.com. And now, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, the late, great Ronnie James Dio, formerly of Black Sabbath, recorded on May 22nd, 1986, almost 24 years ago this week. I hope you enjoy.
Okay, I think we're okay. Thanks for taking time out. How was England?
Oh, it was great. Well, the whole entire year being great.
Go ahead.
I'll just let that one go.
Okay.
I'll put a beep one more time.
That's all right.
Anyway, it was fun. The European tour and the British tour. It was both really great. The best European and British tour that we've done so far. Especially as far as business stuff, it was really well done.
Okay, so these were tours you're coming in from.
Yes, that's right. We did a month in Europe, like Scandinavia, Germany, France, and then a month in England.
Okay. Now, haven't you also been in the process of recording a new album?
No, as a matter of fact, we have an album being released, which is an interim album. It's called Intermission. It's to bridge the gap between a great period of time from the release of the last album and when we'll be able to record and release the next one.
Huh.
So it's going to be a lot longer than normal for us. So we've, because we are touring, we released one studio set, which has our new guitarist, Craig, and five live tracks recorded in San Diego with Vivian. It was done about 6 or 7 months ago.
Mm.
So this is an album, as I say, to bridge that gap between studio albums.
What is the name of the new studio song?
It's called Time to Burn.
Time to Burn.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Can you tell me a little about it?
How about the song?
Yeah.
Well, it's a typical me song, I guess. It's just about the fact that we can do a lot more with our lives than just sit around worrying about it. The point being that we seem to have so much time that we waste, that we just burn up. Why not use it to our own positive value?
Hmm. Okay. And when was this recorded? Was this part of the session for the last album?
No, as a matter of fact, this is very strange. 2 weeks before we began the European tour was the time when I decided that Vivian didn't have the right place in the band. So we had 2 weeks to find another guitar player, to rehearse with him before the tour come up, and also to have to go into the studio and do a track for this particular project. So we're in those 2 weeks, got Craig Goldie.
How do you spell his last name?
Sorry?
How do you spell his last name?
G-O-L-D-I-E.
Okay.
Craig was in a band called Jafria.
Oh, yeah.
Before that, he was in a band called Rough Cup, a band that I've had quite a bit of career with. My manager, Wendy, was their manager as well. He had, at the time, was auditioning for the spot vacated by J.G. Lee, who played with Ozzy Osbourne. And that was the first that I ever played. That was about 4 years. And I was extremely impressed. And when it came time to the party of the way to live, he was the one I wanted. He was going to be right. So we got Craig. Craig, during that time, was rehearsing for the European tour. We wrote and then they were recorded. On Time to Burn. The album is given a little bit extra. You kind of get five tracks that have never been heard before and recorded in American form, you know, in America.
Mm-hmm.
And also gave us the opportunity to have one track with a new guitar player. So you have the old and the new, so to speak.
And what I was getting at was that this track was recorded specially for this project.
For this project, it was, yes, but not from another album. It was recorded.
Okay, and this is going to be an EP. This is going to be an EP.
It's called a mini LP.
Mini
LP. Yeah.
Okay.
That term, you know, I don't know what they mean, but that's what they call it.
Yeah, there's a word for everything.
Yes.
That way they can sell it differently. What was I going to say? What are the other five tracks? The live tracks.
We do them every night, and I get lost in the shuffle all the time. It was Rainbow in the Dark, Sacred Heart. And Sacred Heart includes Long Live Rock and Roll and Man on the Silver Moon.
Okay.
Let's see. I believe it's like Stephen Hart and Rock and Roll Children. Rainbow in the Dark. Did I say that?
Yeah, I think you said that one.
So,
Rainbow in the Dark.
It's something else. I honestly don't remember.
Okay.
I know it sounds foolish, but I really don't remember.
Well, that's okay. Now, when will that be out?
That'll be released on the, I think it's the 2nd or 3rd of June.
Oh, 2 days before you get here.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me double check. Oops.
That's a persistent person on the other
side. Certainly is. If you want to take that, I can hold on.
Okay, hold on.
Okay.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. It probably worked out better that you took it rather than have that person keep calling.
Okay.
I guess. Let's run through the current band, make sure I got this right. I have Jimmy Bain on bass guitar.
That's right.
Claude Snell on keyboards.
Mm-hmm.
Vinny Appice on drums.
Mm-hmm.
You tell me Craig Goldie on
right.
guitar, and then yourself. Same.
Right.
Okay, just want to be sure. That way I don't run the wrong picture.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry. How different is it to be the leader of your own band as opposed to when you became a member of Sabbath or a member of Rainbow?
It's quite a bit different, really. The difference is just the control, really.
Mm-hmm.
Depends on what kind of person you are, too. If you're a follower, obviously, thrust into a leader's position, it would be very difficult to handle, I'm sure. I've never been a follower, so that's not been a problem. It's really all in control. It's that you can do anything that you want to do. All you have to do is be bright enough to use that talent around you so that, and your own, to its fullest extent, so that it works for you. It's very easy to be in control when you can be hit with it. But that's a bit stupid because it's so unproductive, and it's a bit of a bad analogy. I mean, quite often I say about the world of human beings. But, you can misuse control, and that's what makes it so different from the other situation. In Sabbath and Rainbow, control that I was able to exert was because of clever manipulating the people. You have to learn how to deal with this kind of situation. A situation where if you want to be in control, you have to prove yourself. You have to make as many right decisions as possible, and then gain respect, and then perhaps that's a form of control. Then you can use your talent, your input, will be accepted. In this situation, we just have total control of everything. So I could very easily say, well, I don't like you, and I don't like you, and I don't like you, off you go. This is what we're going to do, and I don't care what you play, but you play what I want you to play. I mean, that's a stupid person to do something like that. So this is just another control challenge, I guess.
Responsibility, too, I imagine.
Learn how to use it. Right?
I'm sorry, responsibility, too, I imagine.
Well, it's a great responsibility. That's in the correct use of the power that you have. That's just logical responsibility to me. Again, I can only speak for myself. Whatever is used, it, I hope I don't.
Okay. God, that'd be a great line. I hope I have room for that. I like that. How did you wind up with the gig with Sabbath several years ago?
Well, I've been out of Rainbow for about 4 or 5 months. Tony Iommi was in Los Angeles with the rest of the band, with Sabbath, with Ozzy, and they were preparing, I believe, to do another album. Things had just fallen about themselves at this time. Tony and Ozzy weren't getting along, and everything seemed to be very, very unproductive. The two or three albums before the one they were working on, the dismal failures for a band that he. I got a call from a friend in L.A. who had spoken to Tony, and Tony approached the subject of perhaps leaving Sabbath and putting another band together, and he wanted to know if perhaps I would be interested. So through that friend, we started communicating on the telephone, and seemed to be making some progress into what he wanted to do. He wanted to stop being with Sabbath at all. Form another band with me, much the way I did with Richie. That looked like it was going to happen, and then suddenly violence came, and I didn't hear from him again for a while. So I just carried on with my own life. I moved back to Los Angeles, where I thought things would happen for me a lot easier. I was living in Connecticut at the time. We had moved there from Los Angeles, and they had lived there for a year and a half while I was in Rainbow. Yeah. And going back to Los Angeles, a lot of things started to happen for me. A lot of offers from a lot of people, and a lot of musicians that I started working with that I wanted to put a band together with myself. And in the meantime, I met Tony at a party. I had only spoken to him on the phone. Met him at a party. We started talking to him. We went back to the place where they were all living. They had a house in Bel Air that they were all throwing money away on. And had built a little rehearsal studio in the garage of the place. And Ozzy was... I don't think he was around. I mean, he passed out of the and so I met Keezer and Bill Ward, and we went out into the garage and had a play. And while Ozzy was incoherent, I guess. And you don't have to mention anything about Ozzy. I'm not saying that just to be cruel. That's just the way it was. He was as fed up with them as they were with him, I'm sure. So it you know, a matter of fair play on both sides.
Right.
Anyway, we went out, and the first thing we did was basically Tony and I wrote Children of the Sea that night. And from there, they decided they wanted to not play with Ozzy anymore. And they were going to carry the band out, establish with me as a singer, and with Ozzy on his merry way. So the initial idea with Tony and I getting together became actually mine, Tony's Sabbath. I don't know if I explained that in a roundabout way, but that's what happened.
Well, that's okay. I guess I remember when it happened, and since then, the thing I always wondered about is Ozzy was such a I want to say character, but I think I'll stick with personality. Fronting that band, now fronting his own. Wasn't there a great deal of pressure and expectations to do with following him into Black Sabbath? And the reason I ask is there's another example of that right now. Sammy Hagar following David Lee Roth into Van Halen. Seems like a very tough thing to do.
Well, I've never thought of it that way. I don't know how Sammy views it. I know Sammy, knowing Sammy as I do, Sammy just floats through life anyway. life's fun for Sammy, that's great, that's wonderful. So I don't think Sammy feels the pressure. I mean, Sammy, for a start, had a pretty good career of his own.
Right.
And still does, and I'm sure we'll find out that will happen. But again, knowing the kind of person he is and knowing myself as I do, I just know that he'll want to do something else. Again, for Sammy, having had his own career and the strength of it, I don't think he was worried at all about it. He just got along with the guys and wanted to play with them, and did. And I don't think he had any second thoughts about it. And I never had any established at all. I never compared myself ever to someone like Ozzy Osbourne. I never compared myself to anybody. I never wanted to be like anyone else. I always wanted to be me. I just do what I do. I don't try to pretend to be anyone else. I'm very fortunate that I'm individualistic enough in sound and in the way I write and the way I think to always be me. So I didn't feel any comparison at all. I felt no threat. I never have. But you must remember that joining Rainbow, joining a band with Richie Blackmore as the leader and lead guitar player, was the ultimate challenge for me. Sabbath, another situation. Deep Purple were my favorite band in all the world. Not that Ian Gillan was my favorite singer, he wasn't. Great in that band, but he was no one who ever influenced me in any way, shape, or form. But the band itself, the players, I'm a musician, so, vocalist is a musician for me, so not one person didn't stand out for me. The writing of the band, the technique of the band was fascinating for me. I love that band a lot. And so joining, getting a band together with Richie was almost like having to overcome Deep Purple. That, to me, was the biggest challenge. And all of a sudden, being thrown into that same arena, being a singer who had to compete more with Ian Gillan, with the band Deep Purple, and that was a challenge because they were so good. For Sabbath, there was only cause I was concerned one way for that band, and that was up. They were never my favorite band. I thought that the music they did was so extremely dirge-like and technically inept, but yet so natural that I think that's where the appeal was. I mean, it was the ultimate garage band of its time, really.
Well, why did your stint with Sabbath come to an end?
Why did it end?
Yeah.
It just became personality system, I guess. I guess once again, to go back to control. I've seen this statement, which is the most stupid thing I've ever seen. I think that Tony made it. Of course, most of the statements he made were pretty stupid anyway. But this one in particular was that all I did was use Black Sabbath as a stepping stone for my own career. I never ever could understand that.
That would be kind of hard to figure.
Well, if I was the one who was forced out of the band, then why was I doing it for my own career?
Yeah.
And if I didn't want to give them all the music that I gave them, do all the writing that I did and virtually hold their hand all of the time, but why would I do that for my own career? It would be easier for me to go and do it alone. But that's one of the stupid reasons I've heard. So you can see that the personality differences came in there. What happened was I think that they got very, very paranoid. Good word for them. But they got extremely paranoid about the fact that I was doing all the work, getting all of the attention. It wasn't my fault. I mean, I'm sorry that I was good enough to you know, gather that attention around the band, because it was the band I did it for. But I think that that paranoia and that that feeling of slight jealousy or whatever, that the interloper, the one who was not really supposed to be in Black Sabbath, because that was a band with just the four who formed it from Birmingham, and that's always been their attitude, and I guess that always will be, that the interloper was getting the attention, and that wasn't fair. That was hurting those who really created it. So that's the reason why I have to be those kind of personality differences. And it just wasn't happy anymore, and you can't make good music when you're not happy.
Of course, they've never really bounced back.
Well, whatever has been said about me by anyone, whether rightfully or wrongfully, the things that I have done and the things that my contributing factors to the people that I have worked with, the results of what I've done have always borne themselves out against the results of what the others have done after I've gone. Rainbow, for example, did well after that, but their impact went away. They weren't special anymore. They became, they became Richie's dream of making it in America. And that meant taking it away from how we created the band, what we started with, which was very classical in nature, and for good musicians, and the beginnings of a really great band. But it takes more than three albums to make a great band, and that one ended with, for me, after three albums. Anyway, because of, you know, all those situations, I forgot the question.
Oh, that's okay. That's all right.
I had a great answer for it, too, but...
Well, go ahead with the answer, and we'll just try to fit it to the question.
Well, I don't remember the answer.
Oh.
The question.
We were talking about how the Sabbath really had descended. Really,
exactly. That's how I don't remember what I was saying. All I was saying is the result is the other band had. No, Sabbath is the greatest answer, or the greatest result. They could say anything they want to about me. He was this and he was that and he had to leave and blah, 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 blah. But they're the ones who have made the chaos of their careers, and I haven't.
Yeah.
Mine has continued on. It will, because I believe in myself and I believe in the people around me. And I'm a team player, I'm a band player, just because I have control of the situation. Again, going back to the way we started this, it depends on how you use it. And I've always felt part of the band. Again, I think the results of those who have been behind me have spoken to themselves. Sabbath is continually... time after time, lead to being self-destructive, and that's what they do time after time. So, not to continually come and go on defending myself, but sometimes it does hurt when you see those things in the press about you, said by people who I don't think really meant that, but felt that they, you know, had to lash out in some way.
I understand. Let me change gears a bit. Let's go to something a little more upbeat. And something that fascinates me, and maybe it should, maybe it should. I was very intrigued to find out that your wife manages the band.
Yes.
Wendy. I'd like to talk to you about that a little bit, if we could.
Sure.
Let's start with a very simple, basic question. How did Wendy come to be your manager?
Well, she's been with me through all of them, right? From Elf to... to Rainbow, to Sabbath, and we toured the world together so many times since 1971. So in 15 years, we've done it all. We've been everywhere, a lot of times, too. And so she's seen the same as I have. We've grown up in this business building together. She's seen me get my feet chopped off from under me. She's seen crooked managers and bad promoters and good promoters and crooked managers and good agents and bad agents and crooked managers. You know, I think you can get the drift.
Yeah.
She happens to be a very, very bright person. She's the brightest person I know. With a great, great feel of common sense. A very caring person. The most honest person that I know. Not only to me, but to all the other people that she deals with. She does manage other bands as well.
It's quite a testimony. Was she sitting next to you? No.
No, I just, that's very true. I'll just say all those things about her because it's true.
Well, I
say them about other people too, if I thought they deserve them. Mm-hmm. She seems to be the only one that I think deserves them.
When and where did you meet?
We met in Los Angeles. I was introduced to Wendy by Richie, as a matter of fact. Wendy's British.
Mm-hmm.
And she had known the guys in Purple when she was working in the music business in England, in London. She worked for a booking agency and also worked at Decca Records. So she knew, she had known him before, and Richie introduced him to me in Los Angeles. That was it. From that day on, we never lost sight of each other, ever.
When was that?
That was 71.
Hmm. How long have you been married?
Since 1978.
Mm-hmm.
We tried it out first.
For a while. Almost long enough to become common law.
Yeah, almost.
Almost. So she had been with Decca for a while when you.
Yeah.
And you've been, so she had some industry experience there.
Yeah, some industry experience. Yeah, but her experience was mainly the same as mine. And I was in the trenches from a band perspective. And again, when it came time for me to be able, need to be managed, there was no other choice for me. So Wendy, you've got to be the only person I trust. So she said, all right, cool. She did, and became not only great at it, but became smitten by it. So that's really, really her life.
In a business sense, how is she different than other managers you've had?
Well, again, honest to a fault. Much more on the artist side than on her side.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing I've always found difficult to deal with as far as manager stuff. That they seem to always, they make you think that you work for them. It always felt that way for all the managers I had. But I hope I'm pleasing the manager. And I really never came to the realization until it came time, until I got so angry at it, savage about the manager situation. I started to realize that, hold on, that manager's only getting that top last 20% of me. That means I own 80%. That means he works for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's really sad when you stop and think about it. That, we've grown supposedly intelligent men and women in this business, musicians, always have that feeling and never come to the realization that we control. Because for some reason, managers always set themselves up as the controller. Well, that's so different. The difference is that she's on my side and never makes me think that I work for her. She always tells me, I work for you. I'm trying to make a decision the best I can for you, because it's for your career I work. You're not working for mine.
Mm.
That's just the great thing.
I listen to you both in working for a common goal, so.
Well, that's very true. Well, that's what a manager should do with all of her. And that's what she does for all of her. They are all important to her. She wouldn't take on a client. That's her motto, so to speak. I won't take on any client. Unless I believe and will do 200% work for them. No one gets preferential treatment.
Does the Dio family get 100%, or does Ronnie get 80 and Wendy get 20?
She earns what she earns. Her money.
Okay.
I mean, what is the incentive to earn it if it all goes into one common pot?
Right.
There's no feeling. I mean, that is really, aside from the self satisfaction, that's the only criteria that we have to measure.
Oh, sure. Is she a tough negotiator? Is she a tough business lady?
Oh, unbelievable. Wendy's a classy person. She's really got a lot of class. There are not very many people in this world that I gravitate to. It's mainly because everyone wants a piece of me. Whether rightfully or wrongfully, that happens when you get into this kind of a position, especially people who feel they can learn from. And I'm fortunate in that I have a lot of people who like me as a vocalist, who happen to have good ears. I don't know how many people rush up to Ozzy and say, please give me singing lessons. If they are, they must be deaf. Again, I'm fortunate. A lot of people like me for that reason. So. The whole point of that exercise is that I'm at least looked upon with pleasure by intelligent people. A lot of those people gravitate to me, and it's difficult for me to gravitate to anyone else. But in Wendy's case, I couldn't help myself. We're of the same mind, and she is so bright. And I think that follows through with all the people that she does dealings with. Mm-hmm. She has that aura about her. Something very special, someone that you want to please,
mm-hmm.
Because she's able to please you. I think that's what makes her special as a negotiator. But she is tough. She takes no crap from anybody. And I think that one of the reasons for that is that we are so independent. We have done everything ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
The money that funded this band, the money that builds the stage sets, the money that pays the wages, the money that allows us to to buy the things we need to carry on is the money that comes from, is generated from Wendy's Agile Mind and some of my Agile Mind, I hope, and what I do and what the band does as talented people.
Is there
the difference. We have control. So when she was in a negotiation, they say, oh, well, hold on now. Well, she says, look, I don't care what you're going to do. I'll spend the money myself. I don't need your money. Mm. That gives you complete freedom.
Is there one thing you can point to or think of and say that is the best thing that she has done for my career, either since she's been your personal manager or before that?
The best thing that she did for my career was to believe in me, to always be there when I needed someone to lean on, because we as musicians, again, are notoriously childlike. And we need to be pampered and nurtured and cared for, and constantly reassured that we are good. And I think that's the most important thing to do, to just take on this project and say, it'll be fine, don't worry about it. There's always life after Sabbath, because there was life after Rainbow. Now you lose yourself. I think just her belief in me is the most important thing. As far as decisions go, I think almost all of the decisions that she's made have been the right and the correct ones. And so one doesn't stand out in my mind, because they're almost always right.
Can I ask how old you are, Ronnie?
Yeah, 36.
And what about Wendy?
Wendy's 35.
Do you guys have any children?
No.
Are you anticipating any?
I'm sorry?
Are you anticipating any? You intend to?
No. No, at the moment, the only child I can deal with is a
baby. Well, that's
a big enough problem.
Yeah, I would think. Now, you guys are also have other bands that are managed, either by the two of you?
Wendy has a manager. Wendy has a band called Rough Cut.
Mm-hmm.
She has a band called Alcatraz.
Oh, yeah, two Z's, right?
I think so.
Seems like I've seen the name somewhere.
Yeah, these are her bands.
Right.
She has a band called Burn that used to be called Hellion.
Oh, yeah. I'd heard of Hellion.
She has a band called Fan. Rough Cut and Alphabet are both have albums being released, I believe, in July.
Hmm. Let me ask you this. There's a trio of questions that I've been asking all the musicians I've spoken to the last couple of months. I want to throw them up at you. They're not connected to each other. They're really not connected to much of anything, but I want to ask anyway. And while we're talking about business matters, I want to insert this. I've been asking a lot of musicians about money because it's always intrigued me that, almost like athletes, a lot of musicians' careers tend to be maybe 5 or 10 years, and then it kind of wanes. You know, you can only peak for so long. And I've been kind of looking into what kind of things people have done with their earnings, what kind of things they've invested in, be it land or prop or whatever.
Yeah. Well, in my case, I just bought a building in Los Angeles on Vegas, Sunset Boulevard. The building that was owned by Charlie Chaplin. First home, and that's what I plan on doing. It's going to be a soundstage for video, for full scale production, and also be rehearsal room for smaller bands. It also has 24 offices.
Wow.
It will house DG production, DG management, that's for our related company, Money Windy. It will house sound companies, publicity companies as offices. It will eventually have a recording studio on the property. It will be, again, something to ensure later life will run to be on it. So that is, really like to do put the production and recording in. Someday I will be too old to leap around and say, you can see that happening for a long while.
Yeah.
So someday it will happen. And I want to be prepared. So that's one of the ways I've invested my money by and Wendy's money, she's a partner in this, into building something that will will allow me to carry on in this business, because it is the business I love, and it's what I do best, and I want to carry on. So that's what I don't mind.
That's interesting. It's a chaplain though now, just a big chaplain thing. It's sort of a little side interest.
Oh, really?
I could get it. Oh, yeah.
Oh, great. Well, I'll see if I can find it. I'm sure everything's been ripped off and taken away. There's a studio in L.A. also called the A&M studio. The recording studio, and they have rehearsal rooms too. And one of their sound stages is called the Chaplin Studio.
Oh,
and we rehearse there on Sabbath, and we rehearse there in the Dio twice. And in it has a dental chair, a dentist chair, that was Charlie Chaplin's chair, which he used to relax in his dressing room.
Oh,
he did his dressing room. Of course, we've all sat in. So, in case that interests you, that's what's happening with us.
That's neat. Yeah, that stuff about him just fascinates me. Almost more than watching his movies, stuff about him personally.
Fascinating.
Things he did, yeah. Amazing. let's see, what else do I have here? Oh.
You had two more questions.
Yeah, at least two.
No, you said you had a trio of questions.
Oh, yeah, these subjects here. I wondered if, way back in the 60s, if you had ever been a Monkees fan.
A Monkees fan?
Yeah.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, when they first came on, I quite liked it. I loved The Last Train to Clarksville. And I started to like some of the things that they did. I mean, I know it was all a bit of a sham. I know that they did Dolan sang, and Davy Jones sang, and Mike Nesmith sang, and Peter Thorpe did Newton sing. And they did what they did, you know. They were just a creation. And I liked the way that they were handled. I liked their records. I thought they were, you know, until of course you find out that they don't play themselves, etc., etc. But yeah, I did like the Monkees. They're coming back, you know.
Yeah, that's why I asked the question. They're going to be around here in about a month. I thought it'd be kind of an interesting side piece to whatever story I wind up doing. Just asking a lot of, you know, I talked to, like in the course of today, I'm talking to you. I've got to talk to Julian Lennon at 4:30, and Jimmy Vaughn from the Fabulous T-Birds at 7. And I thought to myself, you know, all the musicians you talk to, you ought to ask them. Get some comments on the Monkees. Make it interesting.
I love the program. Mm-hmm. I love the television program. It's fabulous. It's so funny. It's such incredible slapstick. I mean, it just never ended. I love the program. They're great. I still watch them today whenever they come on. I think they're on MTV for a while.
Yeah.
I watched some of them before I had to shoot off to the air. And whenever I get a chance to watch anything like that, it's like, oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Leave it to Beaver. You name it. Dennis the Menace. Yeah, great stuff.
All right. Here's the last one.
Okay.
Again, totally unconnected. I wondered if, either as a child or an adult, if there was a particular Christmas present or Christmas, just the holiday itself, that you recalled for any particular reason.
I'm going to have to be extremely dull on that one and say absolutely not. I remember hardly any Christmases, whether as a child or as an adult. Christmas is not my big one. I think it's complete and utter waste of time for me. For some people it's wonderful. It's just wonderful for children. Christmas should be for children. It's just a shame that all the adults have to go through all the bother to make it so wonderful for them. Because I find it to be just a merchandising nuisance.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just completely and totally blown out of proportion. I just find it very depressing. I don't know why. I find Christmas to be very depressing. So I guess my mind is blocked all those times up. I mean, I think there's other much nicer holidays. Thanksgiving is one of my favorites because I love turkey.
Mm-hmm.
So as you can see, it's not so much the event that counts, it's the food that goes along with it.
Mm-hmm.
For Christmas, I cannot remember an exceptional Christmas, whether it be a gift or...
That's okay.
I always seem to get the nicest gifts on my birthday.
Mm.
Wendy always buys me wonderful things on my birthday. Christmas, we just kind of do things for other people, and maybe that's why I think it
means.
Okay. Well, terrible answer. It makes me a terrible person, but I can't help it. That's just the way I feel about it.
I don't think it's so terrible. I mean, it's, I tell you, the most unusual answer I've got to that question. It's about a week ago. Richard Belzer, the comedian?
Yeah.
I asked it very innocently. I mean, I don't assume anyone's religion or anything. If somebody tells me, well, I'm not, you know, I don't celebrate, that's fine. And he said to me, he said, well, I don't have a lot of interesting Christmas stories because I'm Jewish. I said, oh, okay. He said, but it's funny you should ask because, he says, once I got married, he married a girl who was Catholic, and he started celebrating Christmas. And he said, geez, what have I been missing all these years? What a good time I have. He says, but he says, I only have a good time because I didn't have to go through it when I was a kid, and I don't have any kids, so I don't get all caught up in it. He says, oh, I just have a good time for whatever reason. He says, it's much more festive. Than, anyway, I appreciate your time this afternoon.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
I enjoyed talking with you, especially, I mean, talking to a guy who owns a piece of Charlie Chaplin. That's just, that's
again,
great.
If I find anything that's really relevant within that building, any memorabilia or anything like that, I'll send it out to you because it's not going to do anything.
Oh, that would be very nice. I'd appreciate that.
I'll tell you what I can do. Maybe if I can remember it, I'll get a brick or something from the building.
Oh, that would be great.
If I could bring the brick with me, you can have the brick. It'll be the brick from his first studio.
Oh, how neat.
I'll try to remember that. I'm notoriously bad at remembering things like that, but if I get out of my office right now, I'll see if I can take care of that for you.
That would be great.
I'll call Sheila and I'll do that.
You bring that out when you come out here?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, make sure I get out there then.
Okay.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Okay, Bob.
Good talking to you, man.
Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.